Welcome to Innovation Calling,
the podcast where we connect the creators for the next big thing. We're your hosts, Aaron Smith
and Sia Yasotornra.
All right, welcome to another episode of Innovation Calling. I'm Aaron Smith.
And I'm Sia Yasotornra.
Today we have a very special guest who knows the world of innovation, and we have Greg Garrett here. Greg, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for coming. We're recording again out of Detroit. Sia and I came up here to visit. And Greg is the CEO of CGS Advisors. He's the visionary of Connected Detroit Innovates, and he's also the co-author of the best-selling book, Competing in the Connecting World, The Future of Your Disrupted Industry is Already Here. He has an extensive background helping companies lead and implement innovation strategies, including spending time as the chief strategy officer for IT and innovation at Volkswagen Group of America. So, Greg, this is awesome that you're here. Thank you so much again for joining us.
Yeah, we're thrilled to actually have you here. So, you know, I guess we'll just go ahead and kick in.
Yeah.
And I'm really interested in hearing your thoughts around innovation in general with your conversations with, I'm assuming, large major corporations. Are you seeing a lot of these conversations move towards how they're looking to innovate, or is it more of they know they want to, they just need guidance on where to go?
Well, it really varies. I mean, one of the things that I talk to a lot when I first meet a new client and start talking about innovation is turning the question around a little bit to them. So if they're asking about innovation, no matter if it's what they should do or how they should do it, if you just ask them what is innovation, a lot of times you get a varying level, even within a room of the sponsors of innovation. I do a sticky note exercise a lot of times and ask them to write independently their own, and then we stick it up on the wall. And what we find is there's four different versions of what comes out of it. The first is imagination. We call it the four eyes of innovation. Imagination being the first one, which is really more of the creativity driving out be inventive like you were a child. The second one is invention. It's really driving out a lot about the feelings of patent counts and doing something brand new. The next one's improvement. You get some people talking about maybe small, like they get cute and they call it small eye innovation. It's just baby steps, which is to be celebrated, but typically something that would be a little different than game changing kind of innovation. And the fourth one is the true game changing type of innovation, taking someone else's invention and applying it for value. And that's at the end of the day, once we can get them to tap in of what type of value you're trying to get, is it shareholder value? Is it customer value? Is it employee value? Once we get that, then we can start having a real conversation about, you know, do you have the right process to be involved? Do you have the right types of access to ideas? Where is the breakdown in the overall process? And then move from there. So I know I didn't answer your question exactly, but that's typically the pattern that I find when I start speaking to leaders inside of corporations around innovation.
Well, I feel like innovation is one of the kind of the key cool words. You know, as we title our podcast,
Innovation Calling.
But the reason why we started this was because I was visiting so many large corporations down in Dallas. Everybody had an innovation lab they wanted to show off. Everybody, you know, they wanted to show that they were this truly innovative company. But like you said, it could mean so many things. Are there mistakes? Are there consistencies and things that you see of companies maybe doing wrong as they're trying to be innovative because it's the thing that you're supposed to do versus really, truly moving in the right direction or looking at it in the correct way? Are they making mistakes versus moving forward?
Maybe. I guess it depends on why they're doing it, right? So if they can answer what is innovation for them and they can get to that value aspect, then you can start identifying mistakes. Mistakes on the surface, judging, going in with my view or someone else's view to say this is what innovation should mean to you, that's probably not fair. I like the game changing. I like the larger type of innovation. I like innovation that's about transforming a company to something that's happening in the industry. And sometimes I don't see that. So it's a little bit more of that small eye. And so maybe my first approach is, hey, you're doing it kind of wrong. But at the end of the day, you got to kind of back up and understand that. To your point, however, on regards to, you know, buzzword status of innovation, I think the wrong, if there's a wrong, it's printing the word a lot, putting posters up. We're changing innovation. We got a foosball machine. We've got a beer tap. We obviously must be culturally innovative now, and then not really caring to get the value down the road. That's the wrong way. Window dressing only. But size of innovation, focus of where they're trying to innovate, that's got to be kind of bespoke to every company that's out there.
So, I mean, when you're talking about companies and they are looking to innovate, and let's be honest, every company has to look at constantly inventive ways to keep themselves relevant, right? Because if they're not, then they're going to go by the wayside, you know, rest in peace, Toys R Us, right? It breaks my heart to even think about that, right? I'm going to miss those giraffes. But
Jeffrey.
Yeah, Jeffrey. Yeah. Right. Yep. So I guess my question, though, is I hear about these innovation labs, but I don't see a lot of investments. Or if they do make investments, it's with the intention of some quick turnaround ROI. Can true innovation occur with knowing that they have to go to market at a certain time? Because I guess companies don't like to make those big, long investments with a potential or do
failure.
They?
Or a very high potential of failure.
Well, I think yeah. I mean you've used the lab kind of as a match or as a physical presence of an investment in innovation, and I think there's definitely value that can come out of it. It's just back to that same thing of what kind of value do you want? So, you know, I've been associated with a number of companies that had labs in the Valley, headquarters elsewhere, and then they build a lab in the Valley, for instance. And if they judge them on transforming the company, maybe they're missing the mark there. But if they judge it on using the lab as a customer-centric point to go have them have a different relationship with the customer, I think there's some short-term value there. If they're judging it on the ability to get access to ideas that are coming from different sources than maybe at the headquarter in the Midwest or in Europe or in Asia, then maybe there's some value in that. So I think that there is value in these labs. Sometimes we believe many times that the right way to get innovation started is actually a centralized approach. So it's great to say I want to drive an innovative culture and everybody's going to be innovative and innovation has to be our business, even though we've been a widget maker. We've been a widget maker for 50 years, but now our business is going to be innovation. That's a pretty big leap. So incubating innovation in lab environments, incubating the processes, the styles, we think that actually is a way to wall it off and make it safe. The challenge is how do you then infuse that back? And that's part of the strategy side of it. Do you still have the traditional business and then you slowly try to incubate it back in or introduce it back in? That could be a strategy. Or is it, you know, you're basically standing up a new headquarters as you're maintaining the old and eventually maybe the businesses will flip. I just saw today that Bridgestone purchased TomTom, for instance. And so, I mean, there's a very traditional company, product company, non-connected kind of company, buying some capability that was incubated somewhere else, and now they're going to do something with it. I won't try to predict sitting at this table what they'll do with it, but they're sending the market a signal that we're changing. That would potentially, if they would have had a lab many years ago and incubated that could have been very much the same way. Incubate it somewhere, build it up, and then decide to do something with it. So I think labs have got their place. It's just a matter of how are they positioned and what's the real purpose for them.
How do – you know, as I'm thinking of this, like just in the workforces I've worked in the corporate America, if you're not thinking in an innovative way, it's hard – like if your employees aren't used to that, it's very hard to flip a switch, right? There's comfort. There's I like my job. I like the way it is. It's safe, right? How do you begin that? Like, you know, you said maybe it's kind of you're setting up two different things and hopefully, but how do you begin to transform a workforce where innovation is not in the forefront of their mind?
Well, you said safe. Well, she was talking. I think there's a big piece of that. I'd start maybe with clarity, making sure we're a big proponent of people are good in general. People try to do the right thing. And lack of clarity of what the right thing is. And I don't mean the tactical do this today, do this tomorrow. I mean more of where are we trying to go? Right. When you don't have goals, when you have what we call goal ambiguity, motivation ambiguity, people will return to the patterns that they know. If you can make the goals very explicit and the goals look different than the goals were yesterday, innovative value starts coming forward. You don't even need to necessarily mention the term innovation so much. Innovation we see as a capability for a firm. We don't see innovation as an end all be all. It's a means to an end. It's something that firms may need to develop that capability in order to be a successful fill in the blank kind of company. Mm-hmm. But we would say start with making sure the goals are explicit. If the goals of today are very similar to the goals of yesterday, the need to innovate is pretty low. If the goals of the firm are extremely different, we want to be a software company and today we make floor mats. That's a pretty huge leap, and the way to get there may require some innovative thinking, no matter if that's buy it or build it or develop it or invent it internally, et cetera. People are pretty good and they typically will find a way to win if you can make sure that they understand where the rewards will be for it.
That communication thing.
Yeah, it's the challenge. People are they're the best and worst part of these systems that we call companies, you know?
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've looked at organizations and I'm like, how are we – it's like they're successful in spite of themselves.
Oh, yeah. Girl. I don't even know. Yeah. Go ahead. So, you look like you had a question. Go ahead.
No, I was going to look at you. when we're looking at your book, and I appreciate you brought it in for me because it was very cool. So – help me understand, you know, how you came about this book and I guess, you know, why would you write this for individuals here in the business world when you're saying the future of your disrupted industry is already happening? It's here.
Yeah. So title of the book is Competing in the Connecting World. And
available on Amazon right now.
Absolutely.
Bestseller on Amazon.
That's right.
Go.
It's a little bit of a labor of love. My co-author, I co-authored the book with Dr. Warren Ritchie, who's been a long-term friend. At one time he was a boss, at one time he was a mentor, business partner, et cetera. And he was former head of strategy at Volkswagen. He and I have been seeing the environment starting to change around, at the time, the automotive industry, moving from automotive to mobility. But because of who we are, we both kind of pulled back the lens a little bit and saw the greater pattern in the change. So what was for us was a single industry really is happening in all industries. And the book is basically written for leaders, business leaders, to consider how technology change is disrupting their industry, which is really disrupting all industries, and then asking them what they should do about it, both at the firm level, what capabilities, you know, how do you want to respond to this? At the corporate strategy level of, do you want to be in the same business? At the business strategy level of, in that business, how do you want to compete? And then at the functional strategy level is, how are you going to actually deliver on that, capability or on that business strategy? And so that's the firm level. And then it's also written to the leader as a human to say, how are you going to lead through all this? Why we wanted to do it is we think it's extremely relevant. We use some examples in there to say, if you were a business leader before steam power became popular, and you were running a company pre-steam power, and you just could start seeing that steam power is going to be a thing, if you knew today what you could have known at that point, would you have made different decisions? Could you have made your company the number one firm in the world in whatever business you're in if you knew the way steam was going, or electrical power generation, or internal combustion engine, what these types of technologies did to disrupt industries and create opportunity? We see the same thing happening with the digital world, the connected world, the IoT world. And we just think that leaders need to be able to say, this isn't scary. Let's wait for someone else to do it. Let's push it off and wait for the juggernauts out there to figure it out. We think that they need to lean extremely forward into it and say, speed matters. If I don't change, the firm may very well die. It's my responsibility, no matter if I'm going to be this one that sees it all the way through or not, that I have to get this started. And so that's really who the book is written for. And we just felt a little bit of a level of responsibility to take our thoughts and put it in a form that it can reach audiences that are maybe not the individuals we work with on a day-to-day basis. And we've been we've been a bit taken back by the response. So we put it out in July, and as you said kindly, it became a bestseller on Amazon. And we get to see the reports every month of who's been buying, and it's been around the world and some really kind remarks. So yeah, we've been taken back.
Well, and I think it's so interesting because, like you were saying, connected is, it's not in the future anymore. It's here. And now we had a guest from Ericsson on a couple episodes ago who talked about 5G, and now it's just going to be more connected. But with that connection comes the data, comes more responsibility. What do we do with that data? How do we handle that? How do we, you know, now that we know everything, what are some of the, it changes leadership in my eyes of a company. There's many more components. What are some of the obstacles you're seeing as, you know, they look at innovation? Yes, besides the or connected specifically around the IoT, but yes, we should do this, but there's all these other components that are kind of scaring us to really take this on. What are some of those that you're seeing or like the hesitations, I guess?
Yeah, well, sure. So we talk about maybe two things to highlight. We talk about inertia in general, mm-hmm. things that slow you down. You know, people and companies can be inert, and we think that speed matters. In fact, we've got a bunch of things to say about why speed matters so much. But on the inertia side, there's these two different types of inertia. There's structural inertia, which is the way the company has been formed and the systems that are in place, the IT systems, the processes, the culture. And for the most part, there was some entrepreneur long ago who was an original innovator who formed this company, and it had some market success and it started driving out. And then they put control systems in place to maximize profit. And that should be celebrated. That shouldn't be a negative story. That's a positive story. Shareholders got tons of value. People were employed. People had the products and services. It's great. But now we want to change it. And that structure likely is very hardened to maximize profit and take out risk. And now we're saying, well, the underlying system has changed. The environment that we're driving in, changing the strategy is easy. Writing it down on a PowerPoint, easy. Actually implementing it through structural changes is hard because there's humans, there's cost. I mean, think for your audience, maybe think of, especially if you work in corporate environments, think of just the accounting system. Let's say you had SAP. Think of the size, the length of time, the amount of money. It's just to change one single system. Now think that you might need to change everything. What happens if you wanted to go from being a product company to a services company? What do you need to change? Now, think of if you wanted to change the monetization strategy from I sell a single product to I want to do a per use based on a connected product. Everything needs to change, or a lot of it. It's just a big facet. So that's one thing that slows you down is the inertia. And then the second thing is just the human beings, the what we call dominant logic inertia. These are incredible individuals that are likely leading these companies. They've had tons of successes. They've had X number of years, 10, 20, 30, 40 years of experience getting to that C-level leadership chairman type of role. But they know the dance that they know. When the music starts playing, they dance the dance that they've always danced. Not because they're bad, because we all do it. I for one know that I probably still dance very much like I did when I was in middle school, high school, you know?
And there's nothing wrong with the Running Man. I'm just saying,
you know,
own
it. If it got me a second date, it programmed me to say that is the dance to keep doing. And,
exactly.
You know, somehow it worked out. So these are just human nature. It's how it drives out. And so those are some of the things that slow you down. And then it's just a lot around the capability mixture. There are capabilities that leaders don't even know that they need to have that are relevant. You were talking about Ericsson earlier, for instance. You know, if it's a cellular connection, just the skill set to turn on a cellular connection is something that a lot of folks wouldn't even think. Well, that's a capability that I need. Or accounting. How do I count the value of data? These are things that aren't relevant in the unconnected world that become extremely relevant in the connected world. So these are all things that are parts of the challenge that we see on a regular basis.
And couldn't it be argued with some of these businesses that you were talking to that have you ever just sat back and looked at the leader and said, whoa, I don't think you're equipped for this? have you really gently kind of, you know, guided them towards, you know, maybe
you need to leave
or find someone as a right-hand man? I mean, how many times have you run into that? I mean,
well,
do you think?
Maybe not that pointed and drastic.
You wouldn't talk like me? Come on. There's a reason why I'm not the CEO.
But actually that right-hand man or that right-hand person, sometimes what we talk with them about is, you know, let's look at your career, especially if they're more towards the end of their career and they're earning out. And part of that dominant logic also can be just on it's kind of the mixture of structure and individual, the way they're compensated. If it's a public company, they're compensated every quarter. And to say you're going to ride your future and all of your retirement funds on the back of putting a change that may actually take the stock price down for a while, that's a difficult thing. So perhaps sometimes we say, who's the future leader? Who's the person that you think will be leading this company after you in 5 years, in 6 years? make them the champion of the transformation project. Make them the champion of the lab or the innovative thing. Let them cut their teeth both in an organization there. But if you really believe that that innovation thing that you're working on is representative of the future of the company, great. Let them go incubate it up from the start and let them kind of rise with that series of business decisions. And if it goes well, fantastic. If not, well, you're still kind of riding out the old train for a little while. It doesn't always work. And frankly, we're not always invited into that conversation. But when I have been, that seems to be the pattern that has emerged a handful of times.
And, you know, Sia brought up Toys R Us as an example. And I think it's very blanket to look out in the industry and say you innovate or you die, right? Like you figure out how to compete, you figure out how to innovate, or you're done. But is that a blanket statement? To your point, like, does it always make sense for a company to constantly be pushing it and say, and knowing that, you know what, I may, our stock price may go, this may, we're seeing the cliff, we got to change, or we're going over. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, like, for sure.
Is there the case too that companies can look and say, you know, right now, maybe innovation isn't for you. Maybe the way things are going are what's working right now and you should stay that path? Or should companies always be looking at ways, you know, blanket statement? Yeah, you should, but it may make sense that it's not the case. Have you seen it where it's not?
Yeah, well, maybe not at that time, maybe.
Right.
There's so many cool things that we could talk about inside that one statement that you drove out, but do you always have to, over the long haul, do you need to change or you're going to die? Yeah, that's not only about business. That's about
humans,
any system.
Yeah.
Environment, et cetera. This is just a matter of fact. And so one thing that's really hard for competitive leaders to accept is, yeah, it's very natural actually for things to fade off and new things to start. That's part of the life cycle of everything, including businesses. Most of us don't want to accept that we're the ones at the helm when that happens, et cetera. So that's one point, is that it's just natural. The second thing I would layer out in regards to, is there ever a time? Yeah, there is. I mean, when you have stable markets and there's not a real catalyst for disruption of that industry or of that segment you're in, overstepping and saying, I'm just going to change for change sake because I might be preparing for something in the future – That's a little risky. That's when you say, I'm going to actually put those folks out in the lab and I'm just going to keep that capability relevant for when I need it. The balance is timing, right? The balance is, well, when will we maybe need it and can I go acquire it at that point? Which is back to why we chose to write the book. We just – right now, most environments, most markets, most industries are under – a lot of disruptive kind of pressure because a lot of things are stacking up. This IT thing, as I understand it, you guys speak about on a fairly regular basis, you know, it started a long time ago. I mean, information technology, take those two words. There's been information for a long time. There's been technology in different formats, but they've been starting to stack on each other. And now that we're starting to permeate the digital and physical worlds, there's not many places that you can escape from it. Maybe you can artificially block off a market for a while. For the most part, this isn't an auto thing or a health thing or a hospitality thing. This is a life thing. And so there's not many places to hide. So for right now, I think it's pretty good for everybody to be at least considering how innovation is going to play into their agenda. But tuning how much you want to turn the volume up, that might be an individual company kind of consideration.
I like it. No, I think this is so intriguing. And we talked a little bit about this before, and I wanted to go a little bit deeper into it here. But corporations, we've talked a lot with companies on the – and I've seen this. It's very cool in Dallas. We're seeing a lot of, hey, it used to be this fine line. Entrepreneurship, you were an entrepreneur. You thought like an entrepreneur. You stayed very far away from corporate America, or you were corporate, and that was your line, right?
Yep.
Now there's this integration happening. There's a lot of – you know, we have seen so many where these corporations are having a hard time finding the companies they want to partner with or invest in. As a corporation, and you're looking at that, like you mentioned, it was kind of the big move of the four eyes. How are you seeing large companies competing from, or the best strategy from looking at, we either innovate within or we go out and seek that, and we really start introducing that mindset and trying to find what other people are doing and bring that into our company?
The best strategy is both.
Okay.
The best strategy is an and strategy, where you have, you know, maybe you're doing some completely in your own labs, some that are maybe in partnership with others. I've used the spectrum before that says, where are you getting your ideas from and where are you maturing your ideas? And you can do it from completely internal to completely external, the external being, you know, M&A, and then maybe backing up from that corporate venture capital. But if you really want to cover the swath, if you're a large enough company and you've got the resources and you believe change is really something that you need to get after, you know, doubling down in both is probably the right way to go. If you've got limited resources, this is the tough part, right?
Yeah.
If you know exactly what you want to innovate on, you probably don't need to scatterplot everything. But if your industry is being disrupted from a whole lot of different places, if the product itself is being disrupted, if the environment, regulatory environment is being disrupted, if the consumers and the customers of your product are changing behavior, if the way that they're living in population, if everything's changing, you probably don't have enough breadth internally to do it all by yourself. So you have to say, what am I really good at controlling? And I might want to keep that inside my four walls. And where can I go partner, no matter if it's academics or external labs or, you know, entrepreneurial type of things to go get. So I think it's an and strategy is the one that I would, I mean, it's easy. It's kind of, yeah. It depends, but I think they have to look at all of them.
Yeah. I think it's cool to see how it's happening. Like even just the corporations wanting to work more with entrepreneurs, and it's exciting. I've always had the entrepreneur mindset, but my favorite job ever was when they kind of set me free and I would be okay. I'd come back with ideas and I did very well at that company, but it was because it wasn't, you just need to sit here from 8 to 5 and you do your thing and then you leave.
Long did you last in the role out of curiosity?
I lasted 5 years there.
No, that's pretty – in that scouting kind of role?
Yes.
Pretty good. The general thing that I've seen, and I don't know, it's not proven. We haven't gone on done a big survey on it, but I've personally seen it many times is – people last in those roles until the sponsor of innovation changes. So, you know, there's a bunch of stuff out there for chief information officers. What's the average life of a chief information officer these days? There's starting to be ones around what's the average life of a chief innovation officer as well. And I think that, you know, the scouts and everything are very tied to that chief innovation officer. How long do they last? How much air cover are they going to have? How important is the idea? And a lot of times these people leave because they get frustrated afterwards, need to go into an operations role or something. It's tough.
Think that they want to go back. Like they're like, yeah, I'll go back to corporate America. And then they get there for a while. They're like, this was not, you know, and they, the politics starts that, you know, at first, what I've found is a lot of companies are like, oh, we want your mindset. We want you because you're going to think, you know, you're going to help us drive this. And then the politics set in and that person, you know, they kind of start bumping up against the very thing that they left, you know, they thought would change. And it's very hard a lot for corporations to, you know, we talked to a friend of ours from Grant Thornton, she was on the, she talked about this. But it was just, you know, it's a very old school company. Yeah. And, you know, to bring these ideas and say, oh, this is going to, these are very black and white thinkers. And to come and say, oh, we're going to have this really cool gray area and let's implement this, as much as they want to and as much as it's shiny, it's still hard to just change it like that.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, the entrepreneur, the role of the entrepreneur and whatnot, grass is always greener, right?
Right.
I mean,
100%.
So if you're an entrepreneur, there's not as many people that you know of that are going to surround you that say no, right? They're not lining up to tell you no. But there's plenty of people that are going to tell you no, and it's a lot harder to get the meeting, and you have to go work the open market. So every day, but there's people that celebrate you're out there doing. Lots of people are going to celebrate that you're an entrepreneur. Man, you are driving it out. This is fantastic. On the flip side, entrepreneurs, you go to work every day and you swim upstream against the culture and you come home kind of tired and bloodied all the time, but access is easier. You don't have to, you know, you're probably getting a salary. So I've seen more and more recently, at least in my small circles, of people that are bouncing between them. I'm corporate and I get worn out, but I've learned something. I've got another something. You know, I found a space in the market that this company won't take, so I'll go take it to the open market. Then they're entrepreneurs for a while. Oh, I'm beaten down. The capital's closed up. The market's starting to shut. It's harder to get the VCs to write the check. Better go back to corporate for a while and I'll be their guide. I'll take them out. So there's this kind of ebb and flow, and I think it's maybe a new norm for people that are in these roles to kind of play both sides of it. And I don't know. I think that people, when you're putting the hat on, you're going inside the corporations and preparing for that. If any of your listeners are saying, hey, yeah, that's exactly me. I'm getting ready to take that job. Prepare to celebrate the process. It would be my suggestion to them is, process seems like it's going to strangle innovation, right? That seems just, I want to be an entrepreneur so I can just get out there. Process inside of a corporation is there to protect innovation. It's there to make sure that those cultural antibodies don't just attack it and eat it. So lean into the process, shape the process, hug the process, live it, but just realize, on your drive home and you're frustrated, think you could have spent all day trying to get, VCs to line up to fund you or, some B2B customer to take your first call and you're still working through it. At least in this one, you just walk down the hallway and you go in and you get a yes or no a little bit more easily. So I don't know. Grass is always greener.
Oh, 100% true. The grass is greener. But as you're recommending, if I were to, let's say I want to drive innovation, let's say I want to really, look at things from a different perspective and bringing that entrepreneurial mindset is in. And like you were saying, you've got people jumping. What is your recommendation for hiring those people? Because I have friends who do it all the time. I could list several I'm going to go work for somebody. Oh, this sucks. I'm going to go do my own thing. I'm going to go work for somebody. This sucks. Obviously they can bring change, but is there something to watch out for, something to think of as you're trying to bring these people in to think that way that you don't want them leaving in 2 days because of frustration?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of things. First, I'll go back to making sure the goals are explicit,
right?
And that there's some alignment between their personal motivators and the corporate. That'd be one thing. I think for your senior people, potentially giving them some level of protection. If you're hiring someone in that says, you're here to shake this place up, you're here to try to change the not only what we do but the way we do it. Potentially considering giving them some kind of pre-negotiated exit package or something that says, I expect you to push so hard that you may get broken in the process. And if I ever get out of here, you need a way to be able to ensure your survival is good. And if not, then you're out. So HR departments may not like that, but that's something that I've actually recommended to clients is to consider it for the most senior folks. And, I think then it just kind of comes down to some human nature of if you've got a entrepreneur who's on his seventh or her seventh startup and they're serial and they've had a couple of solid exits and you think you're going to be able to bring them in any other way than maybe acquiring their company, don't kid yourself. I mean, maybe hire them to come speak at a conference.
yeah.
But don't have them be your innovation process engineer or something. It's just not going to work. So Someone who's got some corporate in the background that maybe got itchy and went out or had lived in the valley before. These would be better matches, but I think you got to care about culture. At the end of the day, culture match.
What I find interesting is that they'll bring these senior level individuals and say, okay, you're going to be our change agent. You are the ones going to make it happen. And then they give zero support. Zero coverage, zero staffing to enable the change, zero budget to enable that change. I don't understand why this happens consistently.
Well,
you just opened up the camera.
I just saw the face you gave me.
I know, he's like,
your eyes just twitched at me there, Greg. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I can't speak to why it happens everywhere, but I think it's kind of that metaphoric, doing the dance or you're trying to make things, you're trying to please a whole bunch of folks. So a lot of times, senior executives that are making these hires or are sponsoring the innovation, they get it intellectually, right? These are smart individuals that are leading these companies. They're not idiots. They really are doing things the best they know. And the frankness is they might know a little bit more about the company than they want to let on. They want to know – they may know that says, hey, if I sponsor, but if I give them too much control, they're going to smoke out immediately. So I need to put some constraints in. I think the approach that – the only way it can work is the open and honest piece. And if you bury innovation way too deep, it's not – then it better be small I innovation or it better be functional innovation of – marketing innovation or IT innovation or something. If you're trying to affect the business strategy, how are you going to compete in the business or the corporate strategy? What business are we even in? And those are the challenges. That's the value statement for innovation. It better be pretty senior. It better be special project sponsored. And it likely probably needs to have control mechanism that says, you don't need to worry. Don't be in here disrupting my current business. start a new business. And then once you're successful in that, put it back on the regular officers of the company to figure out how we balance these two businesses. Don't compete for the same set of resources. Because if your innovation sponsor or your innovation leader is competing with operational budgets, keep the light on kind of budgets, your chances of success, you really better have somebody who wants to, is desperate for the most part. Either we talk about this in the book a little bit. Either someone sees this incredible opportunity, they just know they can take it and they want to go fast, or someone who sees incredible threat and right. They realize that if they don't do something, not only them, but all the people that they represent and their business are going to be out of business. If you see that, then it's all or nothing. But if you're anywhere off those edges of, we're going to try something for a while, better lock it down. Better let it be protected. Otherwise, the operations are always going to win as soon as you have your first bad quarter. That's just how it is in business.
So we actually had a previous guest, CIO of the Cleveland Clinic. Hi, Ed. And he is a great leader in that he really looks at collaboration with other C-level folks and individuals on his team from a technology standpoint. And if a CEO wants to transform their business, are you seeing the rise of the CIO having more prominence at the C-level suite nowadays, or what are you seeing, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, chief information officers, I think they've been kind of – it varies, right, by industry, and they're kind of a misunderstood officer or C-level individual. I'm seeing it all over the place. I'm seeing some that are very comfortable, maybe because of who they are or who their leadership is, saying, my job is to operate the information technology investments here, and so I'm more of an operational CIO. I have a seat at the table, but it's the smaller seat. I keep the lights on, and there's nothing wrong with it. Like that role better exists. Otherwise, you're going out of business. In other places, I'm seeing it much more as the change individual. Sometimes they change. It's CIO and chief digital officer, or CIO and chief transformation officer, and these types of things, or the digitizing the business sponsor or whatnot. But it's all over the place. And I think certain industries are much more progressive. Industries that have been more about information, either call it the banking industry or the media industries, places that have already started this shift maybe a while ago, are that role, that CIO title is a very, very serious officer. In other industries, maybe simpler product industries, non-electronic kind of products, it's still a very important role, like keep the plant running, keep the distribution running. But because they've done such a good job over the years of taking costs down, taking the risk out, they haven't – the way they've played the role has been much more about a security, secure and stable kind of position. And now that they're starting to try to lean in, they may not themselves be comfortable. So they're – sometimes they've got competition. Marketing group is standing up and saying, well, chief digital officer is more about closer to the customer. I'll take that over here. It's marketing technologies, or the engineering group. This is really about IT inside the product's IT. So we'll take that. And there's – it's kind of the three-headed monster of marketing, traditional IT, and product IT, all trying to figure it out. But what CEOs need to do for sure is make a choice and ride it. You can't exist very long with three different pockets of digital leadership all trying to compete and arm wrestle. And the committee thing, I haven't seen the committee thing work very often, of let those three leaders get together and work it out over time. They got to pick a leader and, put your chief connected officer in place and let it happen. So.
Oh, you just chief connected officer. You just created another CXO position.
Yeah.
They're popping up all over.
Absolutely. Everybody wants to be an officer and chief of something.
So just keep making more. All right. Well, Sia, do you have any other questions? Or, I mean, this has been very intriguing to me.
I know, Greg, we can keep going on and on and on. Yeah. But I understand certain individuals might be bored.
Yes, we have Greg's son here with us today. He's been very...
very,
very
patient.
Polite and very good over there. Thank you. Once again, the book is Competing in the Connecting World. The Future of Your Disrupted Industry is Already Here. We will put a link to that in our show notes. It is available on Amazon, everywhere where books are sold, or just is it Amazon right now?
There's 70 Barnes & Noble. All the electronic pieces, not only a handful of physical bookstores, but yeah, You can get to it.
Awesome. Greg, thank you so much. And then if somebody wanted to find out more about CGS Advisors, can you tell them where to go?
Yeah, website www.cgsadvisors.com. And that's probably the fastest. All of our other links are off of that page.
Awesome. Thank you so much again for coming in today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.